Here are some American voices speaking about freedom of religion.
Well, currently there's a lot of tension in America over religion. It's similar to when the Irish came here and they had tension with the Protestants, and now it's the Muslims having tension with the Christians. But I think these things will be overcome over time.
It's important for people to be able to have religious freedom because everybody has a different higher being. And I know who I believe in, and I think everybody should be able to believe in who they want to believe in.
Free thinking is important to me, and that the ability to worship or think in the ways that are best suited for your life and experience are important to me. The U.S. believes that it is special in its religious freedoms. Whether it actually is exercising a tolerance of diverse religions is something that it continues to try to work on.
You know, people should just be free to just, you know, think, you know, believe what they want.
Because I'm against religion, so I want to be free. In fact, there's a, have you heard of the Freedom From Religion Foundation? Yeah, I'm kind of like with them.
I value religious freedom. As a Buddhist, I believe everyone has the right to believe whatever they want to believe without any kind of reaction from the community or the government.
I don't want people making me practice their particular religion, and I would rather just be able to investigate any religion I'm curious about or have no religion at all if I want.
I don't really pay much attention to it. I just think that you should be able to believe in whatever you believe in.
I think that basically most people in this country don't value religious freedom because they take it for granted. They don't come from countries like in Eastern Europe where you've been forbade to practice religion. So I think, looking at it from that perspective, I think it's hard for an American to appreciate religious freedom because we get it so easily.
I think it gives a person a chance to express himself in a free country.
And freedom of your thoughts in spiritual matters, as all other matters, is a foundation for kind of a democratic society. I have to think that there is still some uniqueness to the American experience that clearly historically has valued freedom.
Welcome to Religion and the Constitution. This is a series of conversations about the law and what freedom of religion actually means in the United States. My name is Jerry Dunkley. When white settlers came to North America, there were already thousands of Native Americans living in what became the United States. There were more than 500 tribes, and each had its own spiritual practices. The Native American concept of religion was significantly different than that of the European settlers. The tribes practiced spiritual beliefs that included honoring the land, waters, animals, the Great Spirit, and the community. They celebrated, or Westerners might say prayed, with dances, drums, flutes, and community events. They didn't think of their elders as separate in any constitutional sense, but as part of the whole community. So the idea of separating church and state was alien to them. As the mostly Christian citizens of the new country expanded their territory and control, the belief systems of the tribes came into conflict with those of the government and Western religions. Thomas Jefferson said religion should be a private matter in which government should not interfere. That idea, enshrined in the First Amendment's Establishment and Free Exercise Clauses, did not align with the centuries-old beliefs of Native Americans. In this podcast, we're going to talk about some of what happened when the Native traditions, which whites thought of as pagan, butted heads with those Native practices. Our discussion is not meant to be a complete analysis of all Native American spiritual practices, but as a window into some of the problems when these civilizations clashed. Our guest is Professor Tisa Wenger, an associate professor of religious history at Yale Divinity School. She wrote a book about Native American religious freedom called We Have a Religion, the 1920s Pueblo Indian Dance Controversy and American Religious Freedom. Professor Wenger also studies other aspects of religious history and the role of religion in the United States under the First Amendment. So, Professor Wenger, what happened when Native traditions came up against Western religions?
Well, We have an hour.
It differs quite a bit, and I would say, to speak in generalities, which one always has to start with generalities, I guess, these traditions traditionally did not differentiate or have kind of a separation of spheres in the way that European Western traditions at some point separated out religion from other aspects of life, other spheres of life. And so Native American spiritual traditions, religious traditions, they didn't have a kind of domain called religion that was separate. That came to that in some respects. I mean, some of my scholarship has made the argument that religion developed, that Native Americans came to think of their traditions as religion through the process of colonial encounter. But nonetheless, these traditions are still very much kind of suffuse life rather than being kind of separate from tribal identity, separate from other practices. So,
what do you mean by suffused life?
They're part of every aspect of life.
One of the things that I've been reading is Madison and Jefferson and some of the things that they said about separation of mm-hmm. church and state. And they wanted to make religion separate, mm-hmm. private, mm-hmm. is the word that was used.
Correct.
In order to prevent a government from forcing religion down, one religion down everybody's throat. The private versus public piece of this, does that make sense to you in relation to trying to understand the Native American tradition? That is, it's not just something you do on Sunday?
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk about that a little bit?
I'll talk about it in relation to the Pueblo Indians in New Mexico, since that was the topic of my first book, and I looked at these issues quite extensively for them. In Pueblo traditions, the tribal leadership was... there wasn't a distinction between religious and political leadership. The kind of enlightenment distinctions between private and public, church and state weren't there. So this was something that was problematic, actually, when the U.S. government Bureau of Indian Affairs came in and tried to start imposing certain changes on Native American tribes. For the Pueblo Indians in particular, you know, they had been colonized by Spain, so most of them had been converted to Catholicism. They were Catholic. They were also maintaining traditional ceremonies. Ceremonial practices, the tribal leaders for most of those Pueblo communities were called the caciques. They were, you know, the people who were ultimately in charge. They appointed governors. The governors were the people who were mostly in charge of the kind of day-to-day management of Pueblo affairs and with interfacing with the outside world. But the Bureau of Indian Affairs tried at a certain point, this is in the early decades of the 20th century, was trying to impose kind of modernizing changes and said to these communities, you have to accuse them of being theocracies. You have to separate church and state in your communities. The Pueblos didn't want to do that.
I understood there was an attempt to stop dance and drum ceremonies and this sort of thing.
Yes.
Just like there was an attempt to force them to stop using their languages.
Yes.
I don't know if they're connected or not, but they probably
yes.
are. That was from the Bureau of Indian Affairs, and that was part of their religion, wasn't it? That was the drums and the dancing and
yes.
that sort of thing.
Yes, absolutely. So, I mean, and that started in the 1880s. there was an attempt to, this was part of a kind of assimilationist civilizing policy. The U.S. government, while it claimed to, you know, again, while it claimed to have a kind of separation of church and state, and there is this formal disestablishment, but there was at the same time a policy of in which civilizing and Christianizing were believed to go together. So at the same time that the U.S. government is trying to get Indians to separate their religious practice and religious tradition from their policies of government, the U.S. government is saying to them, you have to become Christian in order to become civilized. And they were putting management of a lot of reservations in the hands of Christian missionaries in the 1870s and 1880s. And they were saying, you know, kind of so-called heathenism was incompatible with civilization. And so...
Well, it's an echo of the Puritans in New England.
They were... So they outlawed indigenous dance ceremonies and religious practices. They criminalized medicine men. This is across, you know, Indian reservations across the country. And so, you know, people could be fined, put in prison... rations withheld for participating in such practices from the 1880s onward. That was always unevenly enforced, and it kind of depended on how, partly on the attitude of specific government agents, the relationships they developed and the attitudes they had towards particular tribal practices. So the story varied about enforcement in different on different reservations, different communities, different times, different agents, you know. But in the 1920s, for a variety of reasons, there was a new push to enforce that policy. And at that time, when that push to enforce the policy came in the 1920s, because there was also a new kind of maybe romanticized appreciation of Native traditions on the part of artists, anthropologists, that push to enforce these anti-dance policies created a whole public controversy and created a whole public debate around religious freedom. So,
and it was, if I understood the notes online about your book correctly, in the 1920s and early 30s, that the tribes, the Pueblos in particular in this case, decided to start calling what they were doing religion?
Yeah, that's right.
And they did that as a way of protecting themselves?
That's
right. Giving them First Amendment?
That's right. And I don't think it's quite right to say they decided to start calling their traditions religion. I mean, they started to do so because they started making the argument for religious freedom. I mean, you know, they said, here, we can, how are we going to fight back against this new crackdown on our dances? Well, here, there's this First Amendment thing, and let's make this claim for religious freedom. And in making the claim for religious freedom, they were saying our ceremonies are our religion.
You're listening to Religion and the Constitution, a podcast designed to expand some of our knowledge about how First Amendment law actually works in the United States. Our guest is Dr. Tisa Wenger of Yale Divinity School, the author of We Have a Religion, the 1920s Pueblo Indian Dance Controversy and American Religious Freedom.
Talk to me a little bit about the controversy, because what I'm hearing is that the sort of the cultural elite in the United States, plus maybe the Wild West shows and all that kind of thing, beginning of movies, which treated Indians in a variety of ways. Mm-hmm. One of them was to make them seem noble as well as to make them seem savage and so forth.
Yeah.
Are you saying that there was this sort of cultural backlash against the Bureau of Indian Affairs trying to enforce these policies?
Yes.
Okay, so that's how that operated during this period?
Yeah.
Was there a legal point where the Bureau of Indian Affairs said, yes, what they're doing is religion? Was there a particular case? or was this a policy change, or did they just back off?
There was no legal case that there was talk of taking it to court, but it didn't happen. I think it might have happened, but nobody was quite sure how the courts would rule. And yes, the Bureau of Indian Affairs gradually backed off because of there was so much public pressure that the Bureau of Indian Affairs did back off. So I was just the reformer rabble rouser who was kind of the helping to lead the charge against the Bureau policy on Indian dances was John Collier. When FDR became president and announced the New Deal, he also announced an Indian New Deal and put John Collier, who had been the gadfly critic of the Bureau of Indian Affairs, made him the new commissioner of Indian Affairs. And it was a whole kind of upheaval in things had already been changing over the past 4 or 5 years before that, but John Collier immediately said, we need to transform our way of dealing with Native people. And his administration immediately announced a new kind of religious freedom for Native traditions, that Native American religions are to be treated as legitimate religions and given equal rights on reservations with Christianity, which had never been the case before. So that was a big change. Was a sea change. It wasn't, it didn't solve everything. And there were all kinds of continuing problems, but nonetheless, it was a major change in the attitude of the Bureau of Indian Affairs towards Indigenous traditions. You still had, there were then swings back and forth. I mean, that didn't necessarily last past his commissionership.
Within the tribes, there was some serious conflict about whether to think of their religion as protected under the First Amendment and its definition of religion in comparison to the history of the tribes and its communal nature, the worshiping the sky and the ground and the water and the animals and the dances and each other and so forth. Well, I guess communal is the word that I'm instead mm-hmm. of the more private separation mm-hmm. that exists under the Constitution and Western history. Can you expand on that a little bit? What was the conflict?
Well, the conflict within several of the Pueblo tribes, as in a number of Native American communities at the time, were divided in groups that were often called progressive and traditionalist. And the progressives were the faction who wanted to kind of modernize the tribal structures, tribal practices, they didn't want to, I mean, progressives varied, of course, as any group does, in exactly their attitude towards tribal traditions. They didn't necessarily want to get rid of all tribal traditions, but they did, as you know, they wanted progress. They generally wanted more assimilation. Generally wanted the Pueblo tribes to become more Western, more modern. Some of them were also had converted to Protestant Christianity, and this is true in certain tribes, especially at Laguna, Pueblo, and several of the others. And some were Catholics and had gone to missionary schools and had come to see the Pueblo ceremonies and traditions as heathen and incompatible with Christianity. The majority of the Pueblos were both Catholic and traditionalist, and saw no conflict between those things. They talked about
Pueblo dances as being another way of worshiping God. But for some progressives, at least, they came to see tribal dances as heathen, uncivilized things that needed to be abandoned if the tribes were to become modern, to become accepted. They didn't want to get rid of their Indian identity, but they just wanted to change that identity in a way. They believed that to be necessary in order to kind of survive or and thrive in modern America. So, and also, you know, and also some of them believed those Pueblo traditions, dances, ceremonies to be un-Christian, anti-Christian, incompatible with Christianity. And some did not want to participate in them, in those practices, but the tribal leaders saw the dances as part of what you do as a member of the community, part of the fabric of life, part of what sustains the whole community, part of what, you know, in some cases, some of the dances were like bringing fertility to the crops, bringing rain. Everybody takes part in order to sustain the community and the crops, the well-being of the whole. And so if you're a part of the community, you take part. So that was a different thing than, well, here we have two different religions and you can choose whether to be a member of one or the other. That's not how they saw it. They saw it as, this is part of the community work that you do if you're a member of this community. And so when those progressives or, you know, kind of tribal dissidents said, no, this is a kind of pagan religion and we are Christians, we don't want to take part in it, then that created a conflict. And so what I argue in the book is when the tribal leaders, in order to resist government suppression of their dances, said, we demand religious freedom for our ceremonies, that kind of strengthened the cause of the progressives within the tribe who said, well, if the government is going, you know, if you're going to demand religious freedom for the dances, then we're going to demand religious freedom not to participate in the dances. So by framing those practices as religion, they also changed the dynamic how the dances were going to be conceptualized in the community as religion. Then you could no longer insist that everybody participate in them.
I have some other questions about this process, but I'm kind of curious about where it is today. Is it our modern Pueblo tribes or other tribes like in Connecticut, the Mashnetuckets or something? Is there a similar conflict, or has this been pretty much worked out over the years that you can be a Protestant or a Catholic and still be a member of the tribe and engage in that?
I mean, I would say for most of the Native communities in New England, in the Northeast region, the history is very, very different. And many of the Native peoples in this region developed large, significant majorities or minorities, Protestant Christians within the tribe. Christian churches often played an important role in sustaining tribal identity, which actually in New Mexico among the Pueblos, the Catholic churches did play that role as well. So Christianity in both cases was not antithetical to tribal identity. It helped sustain it. But there was the conflict that I just described in the Pueblos didn't exist in the same way for New England Native people. Still, there have been for many Native communities in different ways, like questions about suspicion of Christianity sometimes. And again, this varies so much from tribe to tribe.
depending on the particular histories and what role Christianity played. Some tribes really resisted conversion to Christianity and others embraced it. Others had factions within the tribe and conflicts over Christianity, where there were one faction that became Christian, one faction that didn't. So it is a really, really widely varying story. But now I'm forgetting the question you asked originally. So
the question was, have these conflicts been resolved?
For the Pueblos, yes, largely. I mean, that's not to say there aren't conflicts, but the conflicts are over different things. All of these groups remain very much alive and active, but it's very much in certain pueblos, there are thriving Protestant churches. In others, that never really developed. There are some who are Catholic and don't really participate in tribal dances, but most in those communities continue to participate in both. But it's not the source of significant conflict anymore.
I don't know if I'm shifting into an area that, since you said earlier, you know, consider yourself a legal scholar, that is a, and just tell me if you don't want to answer this kind of question, but the Religious Freedom Act of 1994, mm-hmm. Restoration Act, I should say, seems to have given tribes a solid legal way to defend their customs. Do you agree with that? Do you think that they are, that act in 1994 under the Clinton administration, this stability?
Well, to some extent, yes, but I think the bigger problem for Native American religious freedom now was not helped by that act, which is land.
And
so this is one thing that we haven't talked about so far, but you know, the role of land is so central, so sacred to most Native American tribes. This is another way in which Native traditions are so different from Christianity, and that they're land-based traditions, that particular places, they're rooted in place, and particular places are essential to the way the tradition is practiced and to what's really most important, what's really most sacred. And that much of that land, of course, was stripped away from them. And has continued to be stripped away from them. And in recent decades, some of that land that was became public land, National Park Service land, or privately held land in the West and across the country, more and more of it has been developed or mined or, you know, managed in various ways by the National Forest Service, National Park Service, ski resorts, all kinds of things, right?
Bureau
and
Mines.
So Bureau of Mines, yeah. So when particular places that are particularly important to Native American tribes are developed, then that's difficult for that's experienced by them as a serious violation of their practice and tradition, and there's a whole series of court cases in the 1980s and 1990s in which they Native communities made arguments on religious freedom grounds trying to protect their sacred lands, and they lost in court virtually every time because land is not considered in the U.S. legal system to be protected under the First Amendment. It doesn't fit the categories, right? So it didn't work. And the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, which was sparked by the you know, the Peyote case, the Smith case, I mean, that's had some all kinds of consequences for the legal landscape of religious freedom in America, but it had no help, no kind of relevance to the sacred land cases, which have been the primary concern for Native Americans around, you know, questions, petitioning for religious freedom has been around those sacred land cases. Also around religious practice in prisons was another big area. And that, I think, the religious practice in prisons was probably helped by the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. I know less about that whole area. Yeah, and I think it's very important. It's an area that I know less about, but it's very important.
It seems to me what you just said about land puts the Standing Rock pipeline question into a very different perspective. Most of us, I think, in the majority community, mm-hmm. would perceive that as a pollution case.
Mm-hmm.
We don't want to take the chance of our water being affected by a leak in the pipeline.
Mm-hmm.
What you seem to be saying here is that the greater issue for many Native American peoples would be intrusion into their sacred space, their land.
Well, I would say it's both and for them, that those things are part and parcel of the same thing, you know? And it also has to do with issues of sovereignty and settler colonialism and control. You know, who should have the right to, whose land is this, and what does the land mean? Right? You can call that religious freedom, you can call that water purity, you can call that, but, you know, for them it's all of those things. You know, it's not one or the other. It's all of those things. So, sometimes they are left with the, like, well, do we frame it in this way or that way? Well, I mean, none of these categories sort of fit the fullness of what the land means to them.
Let me branch away from the specific issues of Native Americans for just a moment.
Sure.
And particularly because of what you said, your new, could you define religion? There's a legal definition.
Is there?
Excuse me.
I think, you know, the legal definition of religion has always been contested. It's been defined differently depending on kind of the case and the interests of the court in the particular case. Probably the best scholar working on these issues is Winifred Fowler Sullivan, who worked as a lawyer for years before she got a doctorate in religious studies. She wrote a book called The Impossibility of Religious Freedom, a very famous book in the field. I don't know if you've run across it, in which she unpacks a particular court case for which she was an expert witness. And she shows in a kind of ethnographic detail in that case how, in order to make a ruling on religious freedom, the court has to define religion. And in so doing, it's defining certain things out of religion. And because, so in the field of religious studies, religion is famously difficult to define, and any definition can be criticized, and any definition can be called inadequate depending on your point of view. So in this book, Winnie Sullivan argues that ultimately, by defining religion, you are limiting religious freedom, because you are limiting religion to a certain definition of religion. And whatever that definition is, excludes some things that some people are going to call religious. So she titles the book "The Impossibility of Religious Freedom."
Hamilton said, you know, the First Amendment in the press.
Yes.
You define it. You take the chance of limiting.
So there's this kind of fundamental paradox in the definition of religion. Nonetheless, clearly the courts do need to move forward and work according to some definition of religion, and you know, some may be better than others. Some may be more. Some are certainly more inclusive than others. You know, my interest as a scholar, and maybe this sounds like a cop out, and maybe it is, but my interest as a scholar has always been more in historicizing those definitions and trying to account for how and why the people I study draw boundaries around what counts as religion for them, what's at stake in the definitions of religion that are at play in the episodes I'm looking at. You know, I haven't in my own scholarship kind of defined religion because I'm more interested in looking at how the term is constructed and how it plays in for the communities that I'm studying.
Right.
Right.
That takes me to another thought, which I don't think is original with me, but I would be interested in your reaction to the following statement. Because of the First Amendment, the United States has been able to be a creator of a huge variety of what are called religions,
mm-hmm.
everything from the Mormons to the Seventh-day Adventist to the Scientologist.
Right.
And that would not occur outside of the First Amendment context that was created by the Constitution.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, no, maybe?
Well, I... maybe. there clearly one can see new religious movements that occurred in places with no First Amendment, you know. the Protestant Reformation happened in Europe without a First Amendment, right? There were new churches founded. There were new religious movements that developed and emerged. There were, you know, that has been the case around the world, right? So I think it's an exaggeration to say that these things couldn't happen without the First Amendment. However, it does seem to be the case that the First Amendment and then the kind of particular culture of religious freedom and view of how religion worked in the United States encouraged that and encouraged kind of religious competition among groups in a way that did encourage the flourishing of new religious movements more so than elsewhere, than in many places, and more so than would have happened without the First Amendment.
More possible here,
mm-hmm.
or at least historically. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, there are different legal regimes that do make some things possible or easier to pull off. But I also think it's important to remember, so I was pulling up right before you came in. You probably know the Pew Research Center, Religion and Public Life. So one of the things I always show my students is their Religious Diversity Index that came out in 2014.
Right.
And the way they kind of rank religious diversity around the world.
I was just looking at that.
So you're familiar with this. They place the United States not high on the scale of religious diversity because such a large majority of the country considers itself to be Christian. And of course, again, it always depends on how you're slicing and dicing.
Right. My Free Methodist background, but believe me, was not like the UCC Church.
Yes, that's absolutely true, and to categorize all Christians as one, and therefore America is not very religiously diverse, is also a misnomer. But Americans do tend to think, well, we are the most religiously diverse country in the world, and in, you know, maybe in some respects, because there's all of these different, there's probably more different groups in the United States, separately organized groups. I don't know this for sure, but it could be that there's more separately organized groups than anywhere else.
But in terms of, if you think about the major groupings of Christianity, however problematic that whole category is, Islam, Buddhism, you know, places like India are more diverse. But it is difficult to kind of define what is diversity. How do we talk about diversity? Because the way they slice it up is only one way to talk about diversity. So, but I do like to show my students this to say, well, you know, let's be a little more humble about what religious diversity is and how diverse we are or aren't. Because if you slice it up the way that Pew does here, we're not even close to the most religiously diverse country in the world. So, yeah.
And, you know, it's also true that certain strands, brands of Christianity have exerted vastly disproportionate power in the United States, either because of their demographic strength or their political power or both. And shaped the kind of cultural norms and legal structures and assumptions, governing assumptions about what religion is and what religion looks like. So, you know, even such a simple thing as church happens on Sunday, right? And how the school calendars are organized to, you know, Christmas break and, you know, all of these things. So all of these taken for granted norms about what religion is, even the kind of denominational structure of congregational life, the role of clergy, you know, immigrant religious traditions tend to adapt themselves to that model. And so they change in coming to America to look more like the kind of dominant Christian model for what religion is in America. So, you know, yes, it's plural, but there's also a kind of model that exerts pressure on every religious group to look like the norm. Another thing is the, you can think about as the role of chaplains in the military and, you know, how chaplains are licensed and ordained. The model of ordination, an ordained clergy, doesn't exist for a lot of religious traditions, but they create an ordained clergy in order to have chaplains who can serve as chaplains in the military.
We're going to have to stop because you have a student coming in, and you've been so kind with your time.
This wraps up this podcast discussion about the clash between the constitutional idea of the First Amendment and how it differed from that of Native Americans. Professor Tisa Wenger's new book is Religious Freedom, The Contested History of an American Ideal, coming out October 2017 from the University of North Carolina Press. See you next time. Religion and the Constitution is meant to offer a brief history of freedom of religion in the United States. It's intended to help you interpret what freedom of religion means in everyday life. These conversations with the legal experts and the narration will not answer every question about what the courts have said about religious freedom. They do attempt to give you a basic understanding of the law. Nothing here should be taken as legal advice. If you have a problem concerning religious freedom, you should contact qualified legal assistance. Thanks to Josh LaBella for helping with the research and street interviews. And thanks to Tedra Schneider for creating the theme music. And thank you for listening. I'm Jerry Dunkley.